Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Coming up, the world's fourth most populous country gets a new leader.
But first, the quarantine has been lifted on over 40 people who had contact with Thomas Eric Duncan, who died of Ebola in Dallas. About 120 people are still being monitored. No one outside of two nurses who cared for Duncan has shown any symptoms of the virus, including his family. But calls for an Ebola-related travel ban continue. Let's bring in Mary Schiavo. She's an aviation attorney, former inspector general of the Department of Transportation. She has said in the past that temperature screening for travelers does not work. Mr. Duncan had no temperature when he first traveled. The nurse, Amber Vinson, had a temperature, but it was below the CDC's cutoff for flying. So Mary wants a full ban. But Mary, we're hearing medical experts explain today that this virus, the Ebola virus, is much more virulent. The longer it's in the bloodstream, maybe the reason the nurses who worked with Duncan at the end were infected, but his family wasn't. So it would seem travelers would have the least chance of infecting anyone because no one would be allowed to travel that violently ill. Does the fact that people are being released from quarantine, no one else infected, does that change your mind about a travel ban?
No, because we're really talking about two different things. I mean, I've never said or thought that anyone who's on a plane with someone who has the Ebola virus, that the whole plane is going to come down with Ebola. The problem is what it does to the entire aviation system. For the approximately 150 persons who travel or who wish to travel from the three Ebola-stricken countries every day, that puts a tremendous strain on the nearly a billion people a year who travel, and here's why. The problem is, as we've seen from poor Mr. Duncan, God rest his soul, is one person had put how many people on 21-day quarantines, has disrupted several flights, and has disrupted aviation and literally the economy of the United States from this travel. You know, most Americans can't go into quarantine for 21 days. Most Americans have kids and jobs. And I don't think people understand how much America relies on aviation. Aviation is fast and it's borderless. After September 11, 2001, without aviation, literally business shut down.
Yeah. So you're not concerned about people catching Ebola on the flight itself. It's the havoc that's wreaked. When, as happened with Mr. Duncan, it's not caught on the other end. I mean, he went to the hospital and was turned away the first time, and it rippled from there. What about, though, the concern we've heard expressed by medical professionals, and President Obama seems to have taken up, that if you ban the travel from those countries, people will find a way to get somewhere where travel isn't banned and still travel?
I find that the height of hypocrisy. And this is both sides of the aisle. This is Republican and Democrat. But I cannot believe they would threaten the American people once again with our porous borders. This is such a shocking attack on the American public. Everyone knows that the American public overwhelmingly supports secure borders. And then for the government, and particularly the head of the CDC, to say, oh, well, if we don't let people in, anyone who wants to come, if we don't let them in on the airlines, then they'll just go down to our porous borders and walk across and we'll lose track of them. I just think that that is really the government abdicating its responsibilities once again. You know, people said, well, are Americans going to get their pitchforks and their torches lit over Ebola? Well, maybe they should get their pitchforks out and their torches lit over stupid statements like that.
Well, isn't there some truth to the fact that if somebody knows that they can't fly, let's say, from West Africa to Brussels to the U.S., because that's how there's no direct flights, they would travel within Africa to another country and fly regardless? Isn't that just impossible to stop?
No. We check the passports of people entering our country to see if they have traveled to banned countries. If we're not checking passports, we got more to worry about than just Ebola.
Well, and what about the effect on West Africa, the aid workers who may not go if they feel they can't travel out?
Well, see, that's also a misnomer. You know, every year, where technically travel is banned to Cuba, for example, and every year 100,000 Americans go to Cuba. We have special travel arrangements for people performing humanitarian service, medical service, et cetera, and the United States government is perfectly capable of issuing travel waivers in the light of restrictions for people who are traveling for humanitarian reasons. We've been doing that for decades.
Yeah. Well, what do you think should happen for guidelines for flight? We know that guidelines are coming out for what healthcare workers in hospitals should wear, but what do you think is missing for the airlines?
That's just a wonderful question and a very important question, because what people don't understand is there are no federal cleanliness regulations or cleaning regulations for aircraft. There are no federal regulations that say you clean the tray tables with disinfectant, you steam clean the seats or the carpet. Zip, none. So when the Frontier Airline flight got hit with this problem, they literally had to freelance. They had to invent. And I give them a lot of credit. They called the government repeatedly. The government said, well, I don't know, that might work. And when you look at the guidelines, the FAA, and they're only guidelines, they're not regulations, the FAA punted to the CDC. The CDC guidelines are on the web. You can go on their website and look at them, and they conflict themselves. One says, if you have a liquid, you know, bodily fluids, sop up as much as you can, put it in a plastic bag, and tell the plane cleaners that, you know, they need to be careful.
Mary Schiavo, aviation attorney, former Inspector General of the U.S. Department of Transportation. Mary, thanks as always.
Thank you.
All right. Well, some big news all the way across the globe today. In Indonesia, the largest economy in Southeast Asia, the fourth most populous country in the world behind China, India and the U.S., it's got a new leader today. His name is Joko Widodo, and he is the first president of Indonesia who doesn't come from the military or political elite. The BBC's Karishma Vaswani joins us from Jakarta. And Karishma, tell us more about him. Who is he?
Well, Joko Widodo is seen as a man of the people, and it's because of this common man image that he has been catapulted to power. Now, if you look at his beginnings, they're pretty humble. He grew up on the banks of a riverside slum. He's the son of a carpenter, a former furniture seller, and it's because of these humble beginnings that so many Indonesian people who voted him in believe that he can empathize with their problems, that he too has suffered electricity blackouts for hours on end. His house has also been flooded during the annual rainy season. He's also had to deal with the frustrating bureaucracy that can permeate through so many Indonesian people's lives. So it's for all of those reasons that he is very much loved here in Indonesia. And in fact, during his previous incarnations as the mayor of Solo and then the governor of Jakarta, we've seen that he's had a clean, no-nonsense style type of governance. And I think that's the reason why so many people have such high expectations of him. They're really hoping he'll bring a different style of governance to this country.
And he takes over a country that is 90% Muslim. And I know that one of the key issues that he's going to have to deal with is stopping the flow of fighters going to Iraq and Syria to fight alongside ISIS.
Yes, over the last couple of months, we have seen a number of Indonesians heading to the Middle East to fight alongside ISIS fighters. That's despite the fact that the previous government actually banned the spreading of ISIS ideology here in Indonesia. Now, it has to be said that the number of people we've been told by the anti-terror chief here that have gone overseas to fight in the ISIS forces is anywhere between 50 to 100. It's not huge. But the reason that Indonesian authorities are concerned, and I'm sure that the new president will also be concerned about this, is because in the past, Indonesia has battled radical elements in this country. Now, I don't know how many people will still remember the Bali bombings of 2002, when more than 200 people were killed in a club in the holiday island of Bali.
Yeah.
But it's those sorts of things that really worry authorities and people here. And I'm sure that the new new president will be very keen to stem the number of people, to arrest the number of people from going overseas and joining these ISIS forces.
I know that he's also got to deal with an issue involving fuel subsidies. Tell us about that.
Well, Indonesia spends billions of dollars every single year subsidizing fuel for its citizens. If you were to come out here and fill your car up with petrol, you would be shocked at just how cheap the price of fuel is here. So the government has to wean Indonesians off this addiction to cheap fuel. One of the major reasons for that is because these subsidies, economists say, don't actually end up in the pockets of the poor. They actually end up benefiting the middle classes the most. And so what the government needs to do is to raise fuel prices. Now, this is a politically unpopular move. Every time previous governments have tried to do this, they've been met with huge protests on the streets. And it's something that politicians are very nervous about. Having said that, Mr. Widodo has already indicated that he will have to raise the price of fuel. He enjoys widespread popular support. So it will be a real test of his presidency to see whether he can push this major decision through.
Karishma, just tell us finally about what the scene was like there in Jakarta today with this inauguration. We know that the U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and many world leaders were there.
Yes. Representatives from 17 different countries attended the inauguration. But it wasn't so much the inauguration that was the highlight of the day, I think. It was the events that followed the inauguration. There was a party on the streets of Jakarta through the main thoroughfare. They closed this huge boulevard where traffic goes up and down on any average day. They closed it off, the authorities, for this massive street party. And that's because the organizers of this event, young volunteers who helped to bring Mr. Widodo to power, said that they wanted to have a people's party for a people's president. Mm. And I was out there just a couple of hours ago. It was amazing, like nothing I've ever seen before in my life. I met an elderly grandfather figure who'd come with his two young grandsons, and he told me that in the past, Indonesia had seen succession planning through bloodshed, and now they were celebrating with a huge party. That was a reference to the fact that there was a dictatorship here for 30 years in the past. And so a real sense of celebration in the air. Another woman told me that this man is like me. I'm a humble teacher from a village, and I feel that now I have my own president who will actually understand and listen to what I need. So there's a great deal of hope. There are huge expectations from this man. And I think that the biggest challenge for him will be living up to those expectations.
A very exciting day in Jakarta. That's the BBC's Karishma Vaswani, the Indonesia editor for the BBC, joining us from Jakarta. Karishma, thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeremy.
And I'm looking at a photo on our website of the new president waving to crowds today in Jakarta. It looks very different than you would see in a U.S. presidential inauguration. It's at hereandnow.org if you want to take a look.
Climbing walls and sports teams aren't the only selling points for colleges and universities. There is the school's carbon footprint. Yes, that's why in the last 6 years, hundreds of schools have signed on to something called the President's Climate Commitment. It's a complicated document, but it basically says that schools recognize the dangers of climate change as a fact. They understand there are benefits to reducing greenhouse gases, and they commit to heading toward the goal of carbon neutrality. Only a few, including Colby College in Maine and Green Mountain College in Vermont, have achieved total neutrality. Others, like the University of Minnesota at Morris, are well on their way. Earlier this year, that school was awarded the Association for the Advancement of Sustainability in Higher Education Gold Rating, and Architecture Minnesota magazine praised some of the school's unique renovations, including its use of chilled beams. Jacqueline Johnson is Chancellor of the University of Minnesota Morris. She joins us from the studios of MPR in St. Paul. Chancellor, start with, what are chilled beams?
You would have to start with the hardest question. One of my colleagues describes it as being something like a beer can. So if you have a beer can in the summer and it's in a humid area, it collects moisture, and the moisture helps to cool the environment around you. I think we're the first building in the University of Minnesota system to use chilled beam technology. It's much more frequent in Europe, but it's a way of cooling a building thing that keeps the people who live in the building much happier than they would be if they had conventional air conditioning.
And I think you're not just the first in the University of Minnesota system, but you're the first entire building on the National Register to use it. We want to talk more about that building. We have pictures posted at hereandnow.org. But just let's back up a second. Remind us, what is carbon neutrality? It's not using any fossil fuels at all. So what is it?
Achieving carbon neutrality would represent the state of affairs in which you are no longer producing bad gas, carbon dioxide, methane, other gases that are not particularly good for the environment. So it in most cases does mean using some combination of non-fossil fuels, although schools achieve carbon neutrality in a variety of ways. Some schools, for example, work toward that goal by buying carbon credits, so buying credits from organizations or institutions that are not using fossil fuels, and they invest in those organizations and then can claim those credits. Mm-hmm. That's not what's happening on my campus. We are moving toward carbon neutrality through an integrated system of on-site generation of electricity and heating and cooling using principally non-fossil fuels.
How are you producing energy on campus?
We have a variety of resources. We have two 1.65 megawatt wind turbines. Those are the great big ones. And on average, they produce over 60% of our electricity. We have a biomass gasifier that burns corn cobs, mixed prairie grasses, that burns things from the region. Our gasification system can use a variety. It's kind of a flex fuel system. We can use corn cobs. We can use natural gas if the price of natural gas is lower than what we would pay for the corn cobs. We can also back up with fuel oil if we need to. We're on the Minnesota prairie. It gets really cold where we are. So we've got wind. We've got biomass to heat and cool the campus through a steam engine and a chiller. And then we also have solar panels. We just installed a new array of solar panels that are connected directly to a new residence hall. They will provide about half of the electricity for that new residence hall. So we have a combination of non-fossil fuel approaches to really improving our carbon footprint, but also putting money back into the local economy.
Because you're buying their corn cobs?
Exactly right. Yeah. It's a 60-mile radius, and so it's really close, and we avoid what would be more costs related to transportation, and that is one of the measures of carbon emissions. It isn't just what you're emitting if you're burning coal, for example, but it's also the transportation costs that are associated with bringing fuel to the place where you're using it.
Well, shoot, this sounds, I mean, there's the cost of buying the cobs, but I'm thinking you need an entire staff with a whiteboard to track all of this. You know, how much are we emitting now? How do we pull back here and let go there? I mean, is this expensive for you to do?
Well, it's a good point that we need an entire staff, or you need really fancy computers and instrumentation. And so the biomass gasification plant on the Morris campus is installed also as a research and a demonstration platform. And so we have various kinds of instrumentation that allow us not only to measure what we're burning and how much heat it's producing and how we're cooling, but also allows us to measure emissions. There is instrumentation that goes along with it. And so our plant probably added about $1 million in cost in order to install this instrumentation.
That's Jacqueline Johnson, Chancellor of the University of Minnesota, talking about that school's goal of carbon neutrality. You're listening to Here and Now. Chancellor Johnson, you are paying now, but I understand you started thinking about this in the hopes it'll someday save you money.
That's exactly right. So in the early 2000s, when the price of natural gas spiked, the person who was in charge of our facilities said, how are we going to pay our bills? And that was, I think, really the beginning of thinking about how we can use local natural resources to do things that we don't think about doing with local natural resources. Morris, Minnesota is, some people would say it's in the middle of nowhere. I like to say that we're in the middle of everywhere. If you look at wind maps in the United States, States, we are in a wonderful wind area. It doesn't seem so wonderful in February sometimes when the wind is blowing. But
the sun is out.
The sun is out. That's exactly right. We have wind, we have sun, and so that's solar. And we are surrounded by acres and acres of corn and soybeans. And so we have biomass. And so why not use local natural resources either to make your pricing more predictable in the future, to save money, and also to have a positive impact on the environment. And then in our case, as part of the land grant institution that is the University of Minnesota, also to find a way to support the region and to find a way to put money back into the region. And that's what we're doing, and also serve, I think, as a model for others to come and see and to learn from us.
Well, and that's happening with a building that you renovated. It's the one that I mentioned that's on the National Register of Historic Places. It's now your welcome building. I'm reading in Architecture Minnesota that back in the 1970s, the energy crisis, people used to brick up windows to keep out the cold. But you took out the brick and have a more modern glass to take in natural light.
That's right. This is a really beautiful building now, and it was really grim. It reminded me a little bit of a prison. The windows were actually stuccoed over, and so they had little slits that you could that you could look out of, and it made sense, I suppose, at the time. It is now just a spectacularly beautiful building. It's small. It is filled with natural light, the chilled beam technology that we mentioned before. It repurposed old materials and got us to LEED Gold standing, and it was first building on our campus to be LEED Gold. We have a new residence hall that has just received LEED Gold recognition.
That's Jacqueline Johnson, Chancellor of the University of Minnesota at Morris, a leader in the college movement to become carbon neutral. Chancellor Johnson, thank you.
Robin, thank you very much.
And the chancellor says students are choosing her school because of its carbon neutrality. It's a big draw. How about your school? What is it doing? Does it matter to you? Let us know. Leave a comment with this story at hereandnow.org. You're listening to Here and Now.
Many same-sex couples in Arizona are making wedding plans after a federal judge overturned the state's ban on gay marriage. 65 tied the knot on Friday when the restriction was lifted. And for many in conservative Arizona, that was quite a surprise. From Here and Now, contributing station KJZZ, Nick Blumberg reports from Phoenix.
The downfall of Arizona's ban on same-sex marriage came pretty fast, at least from a legal perspective, less than a year from the time lawsuits were filed in federal district court. On October 6th, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear cases on same-sex marriage bans in five states, effectively allowing those unions to go forward. Just one day later, the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals struck down marriage bans in Idaho and Nevada. Since Arizona is also in the Ninth Judicial Circuit, a judge overturned the ban here, and Republican Attorney General Tom Horn decided he wouldn't appeal.
The only purpose that would be served by filing another appeal would be to waste the taxpayers' money. That is not a good conservative principle.
As Horn made his announcement, couples were already standing by at the Maricopa County Courthouse waiting to get their licenses. Nelda Majors and Karen Bailey have been together for almost 57 years and were the lead plaintiffs in one of the lawsuits challenging Arizona's ban. They had decided not to get married in another state that allows it.
This is our home. This is where we live, and we wanted to do it here.
So we really wanted Arizona to recognize us and to, you know, make us feel as a whole person, too, and they've done. And we thank Tom Horn very much for making this decision.
Still, Arizona AG Horn did say he thought the judge was wrong to overturn Arizona's ban, which was voter approved by 56% in 2008.
Voters in Arizona today have had their voices silenced by an out-of-control federal judiciary.
That's Kathy Herod, president of the Center for Arizona Policy, a socially conservative lobbying group. They helped push a bill earlier this year that would have allowed Arizona business owners to deny service to lesbian and gay people based on their religious beliefs.
Throughout this country, marriage litigation is not over. Five circuit courts of appeals have yet to rule on the issue of the definition of marriage. So in many, many ways, the effort to rebuild a culture of marriage, to continue to promote marriage as only the union of one man and one woman, has just begun.
So which court is likely to rule next? Carl Tobias is a law professor at the University of Richmond in Virginia. He says the Sixth Circuit heard oral arguments on bans in Kentucky, Michigan, Ohio, and Tennessee back in August.
And I think from the tone and questions in the argument, there's some likelihood that that might be 2-1 to uphold a ban. But that's just guessing. And so that could be any day now.
Tobias says if a circuit court upholds a ban, that could push the U.S. Supreme Court to take up the issue. But he's not sure how successful opponents of same-sex marriage would be at the high court, since it's already tacitly approved gay unions in certain states.
I think that it really is a signal that there are not 5 votes to find a ban constitutional.
After the judge's ruling, a group gathered at a church in central Phoenix to celebrate that same-sex marriage is now legal in Arizona and in a majority of U.S. states. But LGBT activists don't think their work is done. Jennifer Pizer is senior counsel for Lambda Legal, which worked on the suit against Arizona's ban.
Many people in Arizona don't even realize that same-sex couples here can get married one day and receive a pink slip the next day as a wedding present.
Pizer says fighting for employment and housing protections and anti-bullying measures will keep her and her colleagues busy for a long time to come. For Here and Now, I'm Nick Blumberg in Phoenix.
And KJZZ's Carrie Young and Kathy Ritchie contributed to that report.
Spending on political ads this election cycle is on track to exceed $1 billion. That's according to a new study by the Wesleyan Media Project. That translates into roughly 2 million ads across House, Senate, and gubernatorial races. You may feel like you're seeing them all at one time. But not all ad campaigns are created equal, especially in terms of bang for their buck. Here and Now media analyst John Carroll is with us. And John, talk about this overall volume of ads. You say it's a lot for midterm elections. Where is it coming from?
There are 4 basic sources of advertising in these campaigns. You have the candidates. You have the 2 major political parties. You've got super PACs, which are independent expenditure groups that can spend unlimited amounts of money on advertising but have to disclose their donors. Mm-hmm. And then the last is what are called social welfare organizations, or 501c4s, after the section of the tax code that regulates them. They have some limits on how much advertising they can spend, but they do not have to disclose their donors. Yeah. So that's the so-called dark money in the system.
Right. Well, and you brought this Wesleyan Media Project report to our attention. They say about 30% of that $1 billion in advertising is coming from outside groups, not the candidate. Here's a snippet from the conservative PAC American Crossroads. This is Karl Rove's group attacking a Democrat in Arkansas's 2nd congressional district.
If Pat Hayes can't see Obamacare for what it is, we can't send him to Congress. American Crossroads is responsible for the content of this advertising.
And here's one from the Democratic Senate Majority PAC. It's attacking the Republican Joni Ernst in the Iowa Senate race.
I have talked about privatizing Social Security as an option.
That's good for Wall Street.
But it's not good for Iowa.
If those are her priorities,
she's not someone seniors can trust.
Senate Majority PAC is responsible for the content of this ad.
So that's just a taste, which sent probably a lot of people screaming from the room because we've been
exactly.
hearing so many. But overall, who do you think has the edge, Republicans or Democrats?
Well, you can get lost in the numbers a little bit, but the latest ones seem to indicate that the GOP-leaning outside groups are spending more than their Democratic counterparts. The place where they're the highest profile ads have been in the U.S. Senate races, where outside groups are airing about 40% of the ads. And in the most hotly contested ones, the Republican kibitzers have consistently outspent the Democratic kibitzers.
But the Democrats, while having more ads on the air, have had more ads on the air, even
right.
though Republicans are spending more. I mean, in North Carolina, in the Senate race there, there were 1,000 more Democratic ads on the air, even though the Republicans spent $1 million more. What's going on?
Well, it's the source of the money that creates the discrepancies. Federal law regulates that political parties and candidates have to be given the lowest unit rate from television stations 60 days before the mm-hmm. election. But that doesn't apply to outside groups. So Democrats are relying more on candidate and party spending. The Republicans are relying more on outside groups. Beyond that, even the Democratic outside groups tended to buy earlier where you get a better rate. The Republicans have done some last-minute buying that costs you more.
So different, they're paying different for the ad times. But just in the minute we have, we talked about super PACs. They have to disclose their donors and the dark money spending. Break that down.
Yeah, this will make your head explode. The New York Times says that 55% of broadcast spending by outside groups in the 2014 cycle has come from the non-disclosers, the 501c4s, versus 45% from the super PACs, which have to disclose. But then you look at a piece in The Hill, which is an Inside the Beltway publication. They say dark money constitutes less than 5%. So it's hard to know exactly. Mm-hmm. But there's just a lot of money there.
Well, and it's hard to know because it's dark.
Exactly.
Not a lot of light shining on it. John Carroll here now is a media analyst and a mass communication professor at Boston University. And so what everyone is feeling is true. There's a lot of ads this election cycle.
Absolutely.
We'll link to his campaign outsider blog at herenow.org. John, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, here's something that's going to be on between the political ads on TV, the World Series. Tomorrow, the Kansas City Royals and the San Francisco Giants meet in Game 1. And it has been 29 years since the Royals have made it to the playoffs. So there are 20-something fans who have only known losing and little kids who are growing up with a winner. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, KCUR's Jeremy Bernfeld has the story.
If you need a reminder about how long the Royals went between playoff appearances, all you need is this guy.
Jay Dillman. I turned 29 on October 25th. So my claim to fame is I was actually alive for 2 days before the Royals won the World Series in 1985.
29 years. And it wasn't just that the Royals didn't make the playoffs in that time. The team was often so bad, fans couldn't see the Royals reaching the World Series ever again.
So you graduated from elementary school, middle school, high school, college. You got a job. You got married. All in the time that it took the Royals to get back to the playoffs.
Yeah, it's you put it that way. It doesn't sound so good. Yeah, it's been a while.
It has been a long time. Think back to October 27th, 1985. You were sipping a new Coke. You had a sweet side ponytail. And a little aha in your tape deck. Yep, that was the number one single when the Royals were last in the World Series.
I say, let's go Royals, and I clap.
Can you show me? Show me how you do it.
Let's go Royals.
Nice.
But with the Royals finally back in the series, everyone in Kansas City is forgetting those dark years. That's Will Duke. He's 4 and a half, he'd want me to say. He likes the swings at Loose Park and...
Dyson and Terrence Gore.
Oh, you really like the fast guys, huh?
Yeah.
That's Royals players Gerard, Dyson, and Terrence Gore. A new generation of Royals fans only knows the team as winners. Think about that.
I have a favorite player.
Who is it?
Aoki.
You like Aoki?
Yeah.
Aoki is Royals right fielder Nori Aoki, and that's 3-year-old Emma Hutchings. She has a favorite player, a favorite mascot, Slugger, of course, and a favorite Royals outfit. She says all her classmates are wearing them to school.
For them, it's great because it's never good to follow a team that just loses and loses and loses.
That's 28-year-old Jay Dillman again.
At the same time, for people that are, you know, a little bit older, it makes us appreciate it, you know, all that much more. But yeah, I'm excited for a new generation of Royals fans, and I hope that they never have to go through a 29-year spell.
Because the last time the Royals were in the playoffs, they won the whole thing. And this year, they can once again bring the World Series trophy back to Kansas City.
Royals. If they don't win, it's a shame.
For Here and Now, I'm Jeremy Bernfeld in Kansas City.
You're out at the old ball game.
Yay, go Royals.
Go Royals.
All right, thanks, buddy.
And by the way, Robin, yeah. You know the song Royals, right. The Lord's song. Mm-hmm. There are two stations in San Francisco that are not going to play that because of this.
Because of the reference to Royals. Well, but you'd think the song says we will never be Royals. So you'd think they'd want
true.
To. We're not playing it either because either way we'd offend somebody.
Well, and maybe we shouldn't play any songs by They Might Be Giants either, just
go.
To be fair.
Off our playlist.
This is Here and Now. You may know Mario Batali from his star status on the Food Network. You may know him for his partnership in the American branches of the Italian food market Eataly. Or maybe you've eaten at one of his restaurants. Either way, he has become synonymous with Italian food in America. And now he's got a new cookbook which focuses on eating local. It's called America Farm to Table, and it showcases chefs from around the country and the farmers they turn to for ingredients. Mario Batali joins us now from New York. Welcome.
Well, I'm happy to be here, my friend.
Well, and I remember watching you in the 90s on Molto Mario back when I think there were only 28 channels on the TV. But
it was a different time.
It was a different era. And what got you into this farm-to-table movement? Because back then you were really more about Italian food. What turned you to American farms?
Well, I think Italian food is also very farm-to-table. I think the less time a piece of produce spins out of the dirt before it gets into your tummy, it's always a better thing. So farm to table is a fundamental understanding of the velocity of food and how it should be. My kind of interest here also involves kind of the economic part of supporting small farmers and small farms, because I think it's an integral part of the American society. And if everything becomes big business, we start to lose indie bands in the form of, you know, odd-shaped parsnips and interesting varieties of things that may be grown by a particular family that isn't necessarily commercially available for the nationwide market, but should be consumed wherever they're grown.
You know, I'm glad you brought up money, because I'm just thinking about how this works out in practice. When people go and buy things from farmers markets or buy fresh local produce at the supermarket as opposed to getting some of the more mainstream stuff, it ends up costing a lot more and sometimes takes a lot more time, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, but if you think about the fact that food is one of the few things that you buy that you actually put in your body, then it would seem to me that that would be the one that you might want to take a little bit more time carefully considering what it is, where it came from, and what's in it by the time it gets to your mouth.
Do you think we Americans don't do that?
I think that it's not out of a bad choice of Americans. There's just a lot of places where you have to go 30 miles to get to the big box store, and that's where you're able to buy your food. And it's because America's so big that we can't possibly have a great little farmer's market on every corner like in Italy. So we have to kind of deal with what cards have been dealt to us, and kind of the advantages that we have all can very much outweigh the disadvantages. As long as you can identify local farms as close to as possible as you can and spend the real valuable time doing it.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of the food in this book, because it's delicious. And I know that people just want to hear you talk about food. And let's start with there's a fava bean guacamole. I hadn't even thought that you could do such a thing.
Well, about 15 or 20 years ago, there was this guy in a restaurant called Trump, and not related to the Donald, but there was a restaurant called Trump's in Los Angeles, a guy named Michael Richard, and he had done a sweet pea guacamole. And I'd always thought, geez, there must be another way to use stuff besides avocados that could be something really delicious in this kind of tortilla chip dip business. And we tasted these favas from this farm, and the first thing I thought of them when I tasted them was that there was this remarkable affinity to the avocado. So that's where we went with it.
And is it better, do you think, than a regular old avocado guacamole?
Better is a really weird term. I would say they're both remarkable.
You also have in here tempura green beans with tomato seed aioli. And I wonder how difficult it is to get that tempura just right.
It's not as tricky as you would think. It's really more about getting the oil to the right temperature. If you take the beans and dip them right in, right before you toss them into the oil, everything sticks to it really, really well. If you try to do that in advance, then it's not necessarily as pretty. And the tomato seed aioli sounds very tricky, but if you just think about it, you take a really ripe, juicy tomato, even an overripe one, cut it in half and squeeze out all of the juice, the life force of the inside of that tomato. It is so tasty and smells and tastes so much different than just a thick slice of tomato would.
Are you tasting these things in your mind while you are talking about them, by the way?
I have that kind of brain.
Hmm.
I can get pretty excited about stuff just talking about it.
What do you get most excited about food-wise?
For me, what really turns me on is I go to a market and I see things that are either just coming into season or just going out of season. I love the fact that the regional change forces the American diet, or the world diet for that matter, to look at things differently. And it causes a great variation if you look at it as a 12-month program. So I love the fact that when asparagus comes, and then I love the fact when asparagus leaves, because whatever follows asparagus, generally in our region, morels is the next thing to pop up, and then ramps, and after ramps, and all of a sudden it's spring fruit. And I just like that it changes a lot, because that gives me constant inspiration to develop or remember dishes that I forgot of since the last time that this stuff was in season.
Mario Batali, you now have more than 20 restaurants around the world. You have published 9 cookbooks. You're, of course, famous for the Eataly franchise now, this wonderful Italian market. How do you rule this empire of food without sacrificing quality?
Almost in every location of the restaurants that I own, and certainly in all of the Eataly's I own, people that are working in those places have directly worked with me. And they also have a certain slice of the pie. I never had the manifest destiny of taking over the world, nor did I really ever think I would expand beyond 2 or 3 restaurants. But what happened is, as each sous chef became good enough to run the restaurant where he or she wasn't the head chef, it was either they were going to go leave and work with somebody else, or they were going to build their own restaurant, or if I pitched it right, we could develop a restaurant restaurant together. So what I have is a whole mess of partners or people that have a slice of the pie in each of the locations behaving more like an owner than like an employee, which gives them the power, the control, and yet also the sensitivity to the nature of the kind of tenacious relationship sometimes that happens between restaurants and customers. And it's doing the right thing from an owner's perspective that makes each restaurant operate individually, but also as part of the greater value of the team.
We are speaking with chef and restaurateur Mario Batali, and you're listening to Here and Now. And Mario, when is the next Eataly going to open? Is that going to be something that we see all over the country?
Well, right now, the next one, I believe, is going to be in Sao Paulo. But the next one in America is going to be next summer at the World Trade Center here in New York underneath the Freedom Tower.
Why do you think that has been so popular? I've been to the one in Manhattan, and it's just packed with people all the time.
I think the Italian gastronomic culture is one that allows anybody to join on any terms they decide. And if you went in there and you just wanted a gelato or an espresso, we have that. If you want to go in there and make a dinner that is full on like the Italian feast and it's got a pasta and an antipasto and a main course and a dessert, you can do that. We are not about selling you pre-cooked food. We can make it easy for you. We will prepare the agnolotti, but then you have to take them home, boil them and put them in some kind of sauce. And I think that that makes people feel very inspired that we believe in them and they believe in us. So there's a great exchange all the time. I think one of the funniest signs that I ever saw was the first time I walked into Eataly in Torino when I was deciding whether we were going to be a part of this, and we are because of this. It said the first thing is the customer is not always right. The second line, Eataly is not always right. And the third line, through our differences, we will achieve a harmony. And that is a very fundamental and very powerful way of looking at business, that there's an interchange between the customer and the proprietor that makes something so much more juicy and so much more collaborative that it becomes a store that's a work in progress, and yet you always feel like you could be in it. You could be a part of it. You're on our team. We're on your team.
And you can go home and make something great, which brings me back to the book. What's your favorite recipe in it? What should people try first?
Oh, my gosh. Well, it's tomato season right now all over North America. So I would probably make the tomato focaccia. Then I would make the salad based on that called panzanella. Then I would take the beginning of the acorn squash and stuff them. And you do the squash stuffed with lamb and mint that comes out like an entree, but it's almost like a side dish. And you can use it either way. And then it's also oyster season as we entered months with ours. So I love this oyster pan roast. But there's also a Mexican oyster cocktail that is in there that if you ever had a hangover, not that any one of your listeners ever did. But if they did, this is the cure.
Mm. And I think we've got a full meal there. Mario Batali, thanks so much. Such a pleasure to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And we've got some of those recipes that Mario's been talking about at hereandnow.org and a special web extra, Mario's favorite restaurants in the United States. Go to hereandnow.org right now and take a listen to that special web extra.
And by the way, he's right. The tomatoes, I'm eating one right now. As you can see, the tomatoes right now are fantastic.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.